On the Vocalo hotline, we've got the soundtrack for your Friday nights. If you need to hear that one song you love or want a dedicated track to that special someone, I'm taking your calls and DMs. Tune in every Friday night at 8, both on WBEZ and Vocalo.org.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by Wise, the app for international people using money around the globe. With the Wise account, you can send, spend, and receive in up to 40 currencies with only a few simple taps. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. Terms and conditions apply. Be smart. Get Wise.
It's about creating neighborhoods where families can afford to stay and grow and access good paying jobs and support.
The long anticipated 1901 project officially kicking off.
The museum traces President Barack Obama's journey to the White House.
It sits on a 19.3 acre campus that is otherwise free and accessible to the public.
There's something powerful about a young person being able to place their hand on the hand of a young Barack Obama.
Hey Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons and this is In the Loop. It's our weekly news recap. ICE agents sparked chaos in the city's Albany Park neighborhood as they chased and detained a man. We got our first glance at the Obama Presidential Center campus, and a new candidate entered the race for mayor this week ahead of Chicago's mayoral election happening next February.
I'm Susana Mendoza, and I'm running for mayor of Chicago.
This will be Mendoza's second attempt running for mayor.
Election day is February 27th.
7 months, it's not that far away.
Illinois lawmakers wrapped up their spring legislative session.
The nearly $56 billion state budget passed overnight.
We're looking at a one-time payment of $400 for SNAP recipients.
The largest and most powerful AI systems will have safeguards in place.
Governor Pritzker's build plan did not get a vote.
The mega projects bill was shelved due to legitimate concerns.
Before we get into the conversation, WBEZ senior statehouse reporter Mawa Iqbal, who's one of our panelists today, joins me now to discuss the late night drama that we saw in Springfield this week. Hey, Mawa.
Hey, good to see you.
So it's been a busy month, right? You've been down in Springfield where lawmakers wrapped up that spring legislative session. But what really stood out, I think, for a lot of people, Mawa, is what didn't get passed.
Totally.
Yeah. So that includes that stadium funding bill. But there were plenty of other things that didn't get passed, like that AI legislation, right?
Yeah, it was a package of bills, and it was modeled after what we saw in New York and in California. Those legislatures were basically, it's like requiring these big companies that run these like ChatGPT, Claude, like open AI models to come up with like a risk mitigation strategy and then to be transparent about what they're doing to mitigate people who use AI who may end up searching up, you know, crazy stuff like how to build a nuclear weapon or how to, you know, commit heinous crimes.
Ugh, so yikes.
I know. And then there were a lot of other bills that were aimed at protecting children using AI. So like teens who maybe were suffering from mental health issues using AI.
Mm-hmm.
And then also barring schools from using AI to grade students, which seems so like dystopian to me too. It's like these
a lot of teachers are on the AI track right now. They're using it as a tool, right? It is a tool. That is the word that they keep
have to embrace
repeating.
The future, so to speak.
Right. So I'm curious, did you ever get a sense as to why it actually didn't pass?
It actually has to do with infighting between the two chambers.
Oh.
Yeah, I know. So the House has this AI working group. They did not propose their own AI bills, but the Senate, who had these like this package, was like, hey, here's our package. The House working group said, well, you didn't talk to us about it, so... Yeah, it's kind of a frustrating reason, I would say.
But. It's complicated. I get it. There was also a push by some Democrats for what's called progressive revenue. And I'm using air quotes for the people who can't see me. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, there was also a package of progressive revenue streams, and I also use air quotes around progressive, which basically is a way of like making sure that the state can get some revenue in what has been a pretty difficult budget season. So one of them was closing corporate loopholes, making sure that corporations end up paying more in taxes.
Mm-hmm.
Another was decoupling from federal taxes, right? So in case the federal government decides to withhold funding, Illinois wouldn't be on the hook for that. There's also a billionaire's wealth tax amendment that was floating around that did not get passed. Neither did the millionaire's tax amendment.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. But what did get in, though, was this digital ad tax, or I guess a framework for it. So that's still being litigated in the courts right now. But basically, lawmakers are like, if the courts rule in our favor, we can start taxing what ads we see online.
Interesting. Well, I'm glad you stopped by with those details, but there's so much more news to get to. So let's dive in. Thank you again, Mawa.
Thank you.
Also at the table to help make sense of the week's news was A.D. Quigg, Cook County and Chicago government reporter for the Chicago Tribune, and Quinn Myers, Block Club Chicago reporter covering Wicker Park, Westtown, and Bucktown. He also reports on City Hall. Surprise, surprise, we head to Springfield first. Now, despite going into overtime, the House didn't adjourn until after 4 a.m. on Monday. Lawmakers were not able to pass a stadium funding package. So here's Mawa again, catching us up.
Basically, for those who weren't following the play-by-play with the stadium bill, you know, the House had proposed this plan to give the Bears a tax break on constructing a new stadium in Arlington Heights. So that had been in the works since February. You know, that's when State Representative Cam Buckner of Chicago introduced the bill. And the House had been talking about it, working through it. They passed it. But then when it came over to the Senate, there were some major issues. And so the Senate basically came in. It was Saturday at 11 p.m., so the penultimate day of the session, and they just dropped this, what's being called a Hail Mary proposal to try to assuage and appease to the lawmakers in the caucus who were concerned about the House proposal. And it basically shifted it completely to it being a proposal where municipalities in Cook County, like larger ones like Chicago, Arlington Heights, could create a stadium finance authority to build a publicly owned stadium. And so then the Bears wouldn't have to pay any property taxes on it. But, you know, it dropped. The bill dropped at 11 p.m. People at this point were pretty tired and just kind of like all over the place.
Well, A.D., were you surprised lawmakers were unable to pass that mega projects bill to pave the way for a Bears stadium in Illinois?
No. In part because they wait until the very last minute to do things.
There's that.
Yeah. And there were so many moving parts in this and so many different caucuses who wanted different things that I was like, I was not optimistic that they would pull this off. I wouldn't be surprised if they did because, like, you know, they meet until four and they pass gigantic budgets without anyone ever reading them. But no, there was so much the caucus differences, like you have the city interests over here, Arlington Heights businesses over here, people who don't like incentives elsewhere. I was not terribly surprised.
Not terribly surprised. What do you think, Mawa, on why this stadium bill didn't get the support it needed? What did it come down to, you think?
Yeah, there were a lot of concerns. I think that there was a Chicago branch. So the Chicago branch of lawmakers really wanted the Bears to stay in the city, right? So the initial proposal from the House would have incentivized the Bears to build at the Arlington Park racetrack, which they'd already bought 3 years ago. But then you also had a lot of more progressive and even some moderate Democrats, especially in the Senate, who were like, I don't know how I feel about giving a billionaire team tax breaks. While, you know, it's interestingly enough, a lot of like leaders have been talking about affordability being a huge, huge, huge issue now, and especially housing affordability, property tax, you know. So I think those are the big reasons. And I think also just the fact that the Senate's proposal dropped on like the last day. So they didn't, the House did not have time to review it and then vote on it, I think.
What also came in at the last minute, Cook County Treasurer Maria Pappas, with a new analysis raising concerns for taxpayers. Do you think that influenced lawmakers in any way, AD?
I would have a better idea, but I do know it ticked off a lot of people.
Okay.
In part because it was like coming out of left field for one, and also because it used some numbers that people were like, where did they get these numbers? So one of the numbers was, here's what the actual stadium would be worth to help calculate what they would be missing out on in property taxes. And here's like a hypothetical pilot payment that the team could be making to Arlington Heights. And everyone was like, you can't put hard numbers on a thing that is still being negotiated and kind of make people stick to this. Mm. What I was more interested in terms of the report was, we have been focusing so hard on the Arlington Heights pilot aspect of this that the rest of the mega projects bill, which had a ton of other tax breaks, was not getting fully vetted or debated. This was creating a new tier of star bond incentives, which is like a sales tax abatement, situation, a brand new incentive program for areas around railroads, which would have huge impacts on Chicago developments. All we were focusing on was bears.
Yeah.
But yes, people did not like a Cook County official putting their nose into this debate. But I do think it's important that we talked about the entirety of the bill and what it could have or would have done or who it was aimed at. We know that part of this was about the One Central development, potentially benefiting like a bunch of other projects we can't even name across the state.
Right.
Any project worth more than $100 million. Could have had similar breaks to the bears.
Yeah. Well, before we put the bears to rest here, is it possible, Mawa, that the legislature could meet again this summer to come up with another stadium package?
It is certainly possible. You know, if they meet now in the summer, they would have to have a supermajority vote to pass a bill unless the effective date is later. So it's not an immediate effective date when it becomes law. But it doesn't seem like the House Speaker, Emmanuel Quistrebelch, really wants to do that. We caught him after adjournment when he was walking out of the chamber. And he was like, yeah, no, we're not going to convene a special session. So.
No, we're good.
Yeah,
we're good.
Maybe
and,
not.
And speculation that we're hearing lately that the Bears were having these private talks with Mayor Johnson about staying in Chicago?
Yes.
What's that all about?
Justin Lawrence of Cranes got hold of some FOIA records about communications between essentially the attorneys for the city and for the Bears. There were a lot of talks. It was like, we had one little chat and that's all. But Justin basically uncovered that there were multiple discussions happening, which they said were about current operations at Soldier Field. A lot of sources said it would be very unlikely that they would have six calls around the same time we're negotiating this bill, just about what's happening at the stadium right now.
Well, speaking of the mayor, Quinn, I got to look to you because, yeah, something big is coming up next
That's
February.
True.
The mayoral election. We just got a few months, you know, for that, just after the midterms, of course. We saw one candidate enter the race this week. So I want you to talk about that and tell us about the others who have already announced.
Right. Well, I want to say that the Mayor Johnson is claiming this as a victory. The Bears bill not going forward, basically.
Right.
He's saying,
okay,
well, we got a stadium here at Lakefront. It's the best option. He keeps hammering that home. I guess we'll see what happens if there's anything in the mix. That seems like wishful thinking still on his part.
We still got to find $900 million somewhere, which is kind of a big,
yes,
big number.
This is going to be a factor in the upcoming mayoral race, which many would say pretty much started officially this week because one of the most high-profile, widely expected candidates, Susana Mendoza, state comptroller, jumped in the race. She has been the comptroller for the past decade, the state's CFO, as she likes to say. Before that, she was the Chicago city clerk. Before that, she was a state representative. She's been in local politics for almost three decades, and she has been a pretty frequent Johnson critic on social media, writing columns in different newspapers, calling him out over crime, over the city's handling of the city's finances. So I went to her campaign launch in Little Village the other day. She had this well-written quote, I will say, "Chicago has tossed mayors out of office for blizzards, corruption, and incompetence. Right now, Chicago is experiencing a blizzard of incompetence."
Ooh.
Yes, good wordplay there.
Wow.
Kudos to whoever wrote that.
She did leave out corruption.
But yeah, she's casting herself as kind of both a unifier, but also throwing some shots over at the mayor. And she's certainly going to be running to the right of Mayor Johnson, who is one of the more progressive liberal politicians in all of Chicago.
Wow. And who are some of the other candidates?
Yeah, so it's still forming. You know, Northside Congressman Mike Quigley has said he's running. Cook County Treasurer Maria Pappas has said she's running. There are a few businessmen, Joel Holberg and Liam Stanton, who have said they're running. Kind of the big question is, will Secretary of State Alexei Giannoulias run? He has amassed a war chest. He has, as of the last filing quarterly report, $18 million in his campaign funds. Compare that to $1.6 for Mendoza and just over $800,000 for Mayor Brandon Johnson. So certainly he will, if he enters the race, will have a huge financial advantage. Also, you know, has some, you know, he's known as the Secretary of State. You know, everyone kind of has at least a vague idea of who the Secretary of State is.
And
certainly
what they
we
do.
Did when Jesse White was Secretary of State and what they do. Right. And, you know, his name is on our licenses and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kicking off. The Mayor Johnson, you know, he was asked about the race in Mendoza. He's kind of trying to pull the I'm above the fray thing at the moment.
He hasn't officially declared
that he's running. And he basically said, I'm focused on governance. It's a line he's been repeating over and over again. I'm kind of wondering, when is that going to shift? Because he and his team didn't really respond to, Susana Mendoza calling him incompetent today. Mm-hmm. So how long are you going to let that stand? Right. I'm curious.
I mean, I've certainly asked a million times at this point.
Yeah.
I think we're getting closer to
we're getting closer. And certainly his tact here is he doesn't want to be criticized for focusing more on campaigning than governing. Right. So he's trying to lean into that. Mm-hmm. But at a certain point, you're going to have to get in the mix.
Now, Mala, that stadium saga, believe it or not, was not the only drama down in Springfield. They did pass a budget, as I mentioned, and plenty of bills. So just give us a roundup of the three most significant pieces of legislation that passed.
Sure. So the first one that comes to mind is what was called the Broadview Bill. So this was a bill that limited the use of detention facilities by federal immigration agents for the procedure of detaining people on federal immigration charges. Mm-hmm. And this was obviously brought up because of what we saw last fall with President Trump's immigration enforcement campaign in Chicago and the Broadview Center being a sort of a flashpoint between protesters and ICE agents. So actually the person who introduced that bill was leader Kimberly Lightford, whose district covers Broadview. But we also had, many, many bills that were focusing on youth and how they interact with social media mm-hmm. and just their screens in general. So a really big one is the cell phone ban, basically requiring schools to come up with a policy where students could not use their cell phones from bell to bell, except for passing periods, recess, lunch, but a pretty strict mm-hmm. restriction, right? And then we also had a social media age assurance bill. So that would essentially require social media platforms to verify if a user is a minor or not. And then once they're able to determine that they are under 18, they can't send them nighttime notifications. They can't provide them addictive feeds using their personal data to beef up their algorithm. So that also, I should note, was a priority for Governor Pritzker too.
Yeah. So we can expect his signature at some point soon. Oh,
yeah.
On these.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, I want to touch back on a bill that you alluded to earlier, AD, right? Because it's one that most of us probably aren't aware of would bring significant change to the tax sale industry. You wrote about it recently. Just explain what that is and what passage of this legislation means.
So the tax sale essentially happens when you cannot afford to pay your property taxes for a certain length of time. Private tax buyers have been the main folks involved in this. Basically, they get in because they can charge interest on people whose bills are late. And then at the end of a 2.5 or 3 year period, they can eventually take over the deed to your house by just petitioning the court saying, I've had this tax for a while. I've been paying it. It should be mine at this point. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled a couple years ago in a case called Tyler v. Hennepin County out of Minnesota that system, similar systems, are an unfair taking, that someone's house should not be given away just because someone couldn't pay their taxes. And if it is given away, the excess equity, so how much your house is worth minus the debt that you owed, should be given back to the original homeowner.
Right.
Housing reformers have been trying to fix this for a very long time, saying our priority as a government should be letting people stay in their homes, doing everything we can to allow people to stay in their homes, and not allowing private folks from generally, oftentimes outside of Illinois, to come in and it's a predatory system. We should end this predatory system. Mm-hmm. So it will instead move to an auction system around the state. Cook County's is going to be a little bit different. Essentially, the county is going to take on the debt and immediately kind of try to work on a system, either a payment system where you could kind of chip away at this debt instead of having to make one big lump sum payment to get your property back, or deferred interest rates, basically. So the interest rate that's currently charged is pretty high for folks to pay back. So the hope is that in Cook County, especially where tax buying is most active, that this will help keep people on the rolls, will get predatory buyers out of the system, mm-hmm. and hopefully, including using the Cook County Land Bank, getting vacant properties back to extensive use. There's a lot of stuff that goes to tax sales, like vacant property where the homeowner or whoever owns it just moved away, doesn't care anymore.
That's right. Yeah. Were there any bills, Quinn, that really stood out to you during this session?
Well, I was going to talk about a bill that did not pass.
Sure.
And that is, or a package of bills, which is the BUILD proposal. Mm-hmm. And this is Governor J.B. Pritzker's you know, package to try to make housing more plentiful and affordable across the entire state.
Building up Illinois developments.
Yeah, good. I don't know if I could have gotten that off the dome.
There is no L in the plan. Weirdly.
Well done. So, you know, this would have been a lot of things, but one thing it would have allowed, changed, basically usurped local zoning control in some ways, including allowing people to build multifamily small apartment buildings on single family zoned lots, also allowing ADUs, additional dwelling units, to be built statewide, and a lot of other very arcane, specific zoning building mm-hmm. code stuff.
The good stuff.
Yes. And the governor has pitched this as basically his affordability plan. And this comes as a time when we're talking about abundance and the YIMBY movement, the yes in my backyard, and trying to build as much housing as possible. It did not move forward in Springfield this spring. Organizers hope it comes back in veto session in some form. This would be a pretty big deal. And there has been a lot of pushback from especially suburban mayors who say, wait a second, I don't want the state to come in and say, this is what we can and can't build here.
Right.
Local control is important. We know our neighborhoods. We know our towns. The governor's office and advocates say, we're in a crisis here. We need to build affordable housing. We need more and more units for the state to continue to grow. So we need to do this now. So that's kind of where the tensions lie.
Well, give us a couple more, Mawa, that, did not pass this session.
Yeah, I was actually going to say that the build was probably the most consequential one of the governor's proposals that didn't pass. And, you know, it's something that a lot of lawmakers were saying was really ambitious. But I think there was a lot of discomfort from lawmakers whose district represents like home rule municipalities. You know, they just didn't feel comfortable with the particular part of the build package that would basically preempt local control and create like a statewide zoning standard. But I will say another one of his pretty ambitious big proposals that did not get through was the data center legislation.
Right,
so
yes.
That's obviously become a more hot button issue. It's on top of a lot of people's minds. Mm-hmm. And he proposed suspending for 2 years this tax credit for data center construction. And there was a bill that would do that, but also require that data centers come up with their own source of energy so they're not sapping from the grid and then inadvertently causing people's energy bills to mm-hmm. increase. But that didn't really go anywhere either.
Are they dead now, or could they pop up again in the summer or fall or next year?
They could. I mean, this summer is pretty important, I think, for those lawmakers to like get together with the different people, like particularly the opponents, right? And other lawmakers in their caucus who were like concerned about it. The data center one also faced similar issues of like local control, right? So like, you know, what can municipalities and counties do when it comes to like regulating the data center? So we'll see.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by Wise, the app for international people using money around the globe. With the Wise account, you can send, spend, and receive in up to 40 currencies with only a few simple taps. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. Terms and conditions apply. Be smart. Get Wise.
So a lot of people are getting excited, AD. Of course, this is about the official opening of the Obama Presidential Center happening on June 19th. The media just got a preview of the space and you were there. So I want you to just take us on a little tour of the museum.
So I last got to see it, one of the hard hat tours in October, mm-hmm. and saw the inside spaces, the atriums, where there is light. A lot of the criticism is about there's no light, what you have to do when you have artifacts to preserve.
right.
But it was the first time I got to see any of the exhibits in the museum. And I'm a museum junkie. I'm like the person who reads every single plaque and stares at everything for a really long time and sits around with my thoughts. So
I'm hearing that it's going to take a couple days for folks to get through. Like this is like at least a two-day visit.
There's so much information. And even as I was reading the information, I was like, there's not enough. There's not enough on when he was in the state Senate.
We or just
like,
can't please you, AD.
His 2000 campaign against Bobby Rush. Like all those kinds of things mm-hmm. I really wanted. But I think there is kind of, this was their goal, to have something for everyone and to leave people feeling hopeful and empowered that as an individual, they can make change, which is like so Obama, right?
Very much.
So the first floor is kind of the progressive movements that laid the foundation for what Obama believes and cares about. So it was like history of the New Deal, voting rights, women's suffrage. And then you kind of move into his and Michelle Obama's early childhoods, their time in Chicago. There's so much Harold Washington, which is what I was watching out for. Mm-hmm. Moves into the first campaign. First campaign is like one wall with a timeline, which leaves so much out. But you can't be everything to anyone. There's also a giant button display. I'm a political button collector. Ooh. They have a whole wall. I believe the number is 444 buttons just from the 2008 campaign alone.
Wow.
That's amazing.
Thank you for thinking so.
That's a lot of buttons.
It's a lot of buttons. You move up an elevator to the second floor, which is about his time in office. So like actual policy goals. Again, so much to cover. That's like interlaced with videos with the folks from the administration, letters from constituents at the time. And like, they have the president's lucky charms. So stuff that that got handed to him at events that he carried around with him to like remind him of who he was representing.
The detail here.
Really good interactives, very accessible. There's captions and ASL interpretation, Braille everywhere. The third floor is what they describe as kind of the palate cleanser. So this has the the Oval Office model. I got in there very late and was told I couldn't go in by one person, but was told by one person I could go in. And I went in there, and if anyone is familiar with the under-the-desk news woman, she was under the Resolute desk doing the news.
Oh my gosh.
Very jealous. That also has Michelle Obama's dresses, which are on rotation for conservation purposes. So if you go now, you might see a different one in a year, which is very thrilling. Mm. Sports memorabilia, stuff like that. And then the top floor is like, here's what we accomplished and is kind of what's left to do and kind of the work of the foundation. So climate change, tribal rights, LGBTQ.
Mm.
The big wins floor.
Still sounds very thorough.
There's a lot of there, and there are people who will be disappointed that there's not I'm disappointed there's not enough about like his political upcoming and like the ups and downs and the weird circumstances that like ultimately got him into the U.S. Senate. But I think they tried their best to get as much in there and acknowledge the stuff. They literally have little plaques that say, "Here's what we didn't get done." Essentially, so they had like an employment one. Related to the financial crisis, and they were like, what we didn't get done was better unionization rights, raising the minimum wage, paid sick and family leave. So they acknowledge, like, there's a lot more we could have done.
That's interesting.
Here's what you, member of the public, member of this democratic system, can do to pull this off. They also have, like, a little section on, like, here's how democracy works. Here's why free speech is important. Vote on what you think is important. Here's how the three branches of government work. So there's, like, there's stuff for kids. There's stuff for adults. There's stuff for political junkies.
Very cool. Are you still hearing reactions from people about the architecture?
Oh, yeah.
Because it was so much controversy over what the building itself looks like.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. The monolith.
People thought
it
was such an eyesore.
People hate brutalism. They're calling it the Obama-lisk.
Yeah, it's a brutalist style.
Brutalist style, but
it catches the eye.
It definitely catches the eye. I mean, I think one thing that I'm looking forward to that I think is really cool is all of the art, the local art that's coming in.
The art is remarkable.
And I think
remarkable.
That kind of, you know, softens some of the more... you know, the brutalist-esque architecture. There's this three-story painting by Mark Bradford of the South Side. I'm just looking at a picture of it here from my colleague Maxwell Evans' story. And it's amazing. It looks at the street grid, the lake, all the parks on the South Side,
beautiful.
The train lines, and it's huge. So I can't wait to just stand in front of it and like really soak it in. And, you know, we talk about sense of place, and I think, you know, the Obamas would not have become the Obamas without Chicago. And so, you know, there's plenty of valid criticism to be made about certainly their legacy and also this very presidential center. But I do think that, you know, their homage to the South Side in Chicago is pretty cool.
Yeah. What are you looking forward to seeing up close, Moa?
Yeah, so I haven't been yet. And I'll be honest, when so in 2008, I was only 10 years old. So I don't really remember his presidential campaign. And I do. I'm sorry.
Yourself in the heart. A.D. Quigg with a dramatic reaction, too. So you don't really remember his. So
I really
you're
don't.
Kind of starting from scratch when you take a look.
You're
going to
have a completely different perspective. you're going to have a totally different, because
yeah.
when
I love that though,
when you or I or Quinn would go through, we'd be like, oh, I remember that.
That's and like, not how that happened.
Or yeah. like, oh my gosh, that's how it happened. And I forgot what that felt like. I think a lot of people wow. that went through, which is exactly what they wanted, left with a feeling of hope and like, oh my gosh, do you remember when the country was like this? And we
right.
had this, we had this feeling of hopefulness about so many things about the future.
So there's the huge tower. There's also an outdoor campus.
Yes.
Tell us a bit more about that, AD, and just the overall impact you think this place is going to have on Jackson Park.
The parkland is gorgeous, beautifully landscaped, but it's mostly twisting paths like around landscaping. There is a great lawn where they're going to do movie viewings and where you can have picnics. They have space for grilling. They have a vegetable garden. Mm. There's still a lot of public art scattered throughout the whole campus, which is free to everybody. Everyone,
that's cool.
And they want everything. They want the community to come into this center and use it again. If I were in that neighborhood, I would just be excited to have that kind of access from Stony directly to Jackson Park
mm-hmm.
instead of having to go around the entire campus.
That's right, yeah.
And it's so that's all woven in again. The playground is awesome. It's got that squishy material on the ground.
Good for
and
kids.
Yes, John Robertson, who's the head of operations who used to work for the city of Chicago, said this is one of the biggest playgrounds on the South Side.
Mm, wow.
Which I think people will really look forward to. There's a smallish branch of the Chicago Public Library. Any new library is just fun because everything's like shiny, new. No coffee has been spilled on any of the chairs.
Right.
Everything is available. And this is where, hypothetically, you could go to actually look up the digital records from the Obama White House, because this is not a traditional presidential library where you could go and look directly at documents. It's all digital. It's run completely separately by the National Archives and Records Administration. Plenty of places to sit, which is something I care about in Parkland. I have not yet figured out, and maybe it's just because I couldn't make that walk, when the fences come down, how it will interact with Jackson Park on the
oh,
south
yeah.
side.
On the other side, yes.
It's up on, kind of up on a hill in a sense, and there's like... the whole thing is meant to be very water retention-y, water retention friendly. Like some of the actual spaces are going to like fill up with water when it rains, which will be cool. But I'll be interested to see how people access what used to be Cornell and what is now going to be like a pedestrian walking path.
Right. Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking that too about I was looking at the backside and thinking, okay, how is that going to
right.
sort of, you know, bleed into like, you know, Osaka Garden, that yeah. little bridge in the back there.
Well, and how people will use home court, which is the beautiful basketball court.
NBA sized.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
NBA sized.
That's great.
We could not stand on the court. They were like, do not. Don't.
Because they're saving it for Barack Obama himself.
I'm
He's
sure.
going to have the first walk on the court.
First three. And
probably the first three-pointer. Yeah. Exactly.
He better make it.
Right.
He
right.
has to.
Now, Mawa, you know, he spent, as AD mentioned there, plenty of time in Springfield.
Totally. I mean,
he served three terms as a state senator, announcing his presidential campaign from the steps of the old state capitol to... Are state lawmakers planning to do anything in collab with the Obama Foundation?
Yeah, so I haven't seen like official announcements yet, but you know, we have a lot of state lawmakers who definitely have very strong ties and are doing a lot of work with the Obama Center. So like Speaker Chris Welch, for example, like he had like a private dinner at the Obama Center Foundation before like or ahead of this opening.
Mm-hmm.
And then Senator Preston as well, he's the Senate chair of the Illinois Black Legislative Caucus. And so he did a bunch of tours at the center before its official opening. And then you also have leader Cam Buckner, who is also leading the Bears charge in Springfield.
Yeah.
But he's hosting a community watch party, which I think is super cool.
It's his district, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's
exactly.
his district.
Yeah.
yeah. So like people can come to a certain location and then like watch it as it opens, which I think is really, really cool.
That's
and kind of goes up to that communal aspect, you know, where this is a thing that everyone in the community can like be involved
right.
in.
It's yeah. interesting. Obama's still such a potent political force. Everyone wants a piece of him, even
oh,
though
yeah.
he's been out of office for a decade.
1,000%.
Yep.
Now, Quinn, I want to turn to another massive development just breaking ground, actually. Talk to us about what's happening around the United Center.
Yes, this is the much-awaited 1901 project, named because the United Center's address, of course, is 1901 West Madison Street. And this is the $7 billion makeover of all of those parking lots around the United Center. If you've ever gone to the United Center, you're like, okay, there's way too much empty space here, right?
right,
it's very obvious. So basically, they are spending a ton of money to turn that into a, you know, housing, hotels, a music venue, parks, restaurants, this huge campus that's really going to reimagine the entire Near West Side. And, you know, the first phase is going to come online hopefully in a couple of years. The whole thing is going to last until like 2040. So if you live over there, you're going to be near construction for a long time. But pretty much everyone is talking about how great this is going to be. You know, it's led by the Reinsdorf and Wirtz families. They, you know, jointly own the United Center. And of course, Reinsdorf owns the Blackhawks and Wirtz, Reinsdorf owns the Bulls and Wirtz owns the Blackhawks. But it's definitely a big deal, a big economic generator. At least that's the hope. Mayor Johnson's very excited about it. It will have up to potentially 9,500 or so housing units, if it all that's goes according
which
to plan.
Which is almost like incomprehensible.
Yeah, that's, I'm like, that's yeah. a lot.
And if, you know, if that's, if 20% of that is earmarked as affordable, that's going to be almost 2,000, you know, affordable units. So it is a very big deal. There's a lot of buzz around it. And it did kind of take a little while to get off the ground, but construction is ongoing.
Well, you mentioned Mayor Johnson's excitement. Of course, he calls the West Side home. We know that. And he took this groundbreaking as an opportunity to kind of give everybody a history lesson on the neighborhood.
Nearly six decades ago, following the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., this community experienced profound pain and upheaval. The scars that followed were not only physical, but they were also economical and generational. And here on the West Side, we also carry the legacy of the late, great Chairman Fred Hampton, who understood as a freedom fighter. He challenged us to build a city that ensure that every single neighborhood is seen, valued, and invested in. And while the challenges facing our city today are different, the responsibility certainly remains the same. To invest in people, to invest in neighborhoods, and to ensure that communities that have given so much to Chicago share in its growth and prosperity.
So it was April 5th, 1968, the day after Martin Luther King was assassinated, that riots broke out on the West Side. There were 36 fires. An estimated 200 buildings were destroyed and more than 2,000 people were arrested. And of course, the scars from those riots remain to this day. So, Quinn, I wonder if, you know, this development you think could bring the change and the investment on the West Side that they've been waiting decades for.
Certainly that's the goal. And again, there's a ton of vacant land around the United Center.
So much.
I mean, there used to be a lot of public housing over there that was torn down. That's its own legacy. Yeah, the mayor mentioned Fred Hampton, who was murdered by Chicago police a few blocks west of the United Center. So there is a lot of trauma in this area. And so I think the goal is to, you know, bring in investment. Let's not forget, though, the Wirtzes and the Reinsdorfs would not be doing this if it were not going to make them a ton of money.
Yeah,
so I don't think that they are investing, you know, potentially billions of dollars
out of the goodness of their hearts.
to, you know, right the wrongs of, you know, on the West Side. But certainly they are investing a lot of money, and the affordable housing component is a big deal in this, too.
And it's, AD, what, a $55 million tax break that developers are receiving here?
Correct. They're getting what's called a 7B, one of my favorite incentives.
A 7B. Could you see the developers coming back to the city for more tax incentives?
Oh, yeah. But of course, they don't want to talk about that ahead of time.
Right.
Or, Mawa, could they come to the state looking for money?
They definitely could. Yeah, they definitely could. Although I haven't heard much about it being discussed in Springfield, but I can definitely see it being something that's part of a wish list, right?
Well, the big wish list item I think all of us are focused on as transit lovers, they changed the boundaries of the tax increment financing district that surrounds that development. And the hope is the tax payments that do make it into the TIF are then used to create a new Pink Line station in
right.
the area.
But let's not forget the Green Line just opened.
That's right.
Right on the other side as well, too, right. Which cost, you know, almost $100 million.
Pretty penny. Before we take a quick pause, Quinn, I want to highlight some reporting you just did on another issue involving developing and housing.
That's right. So this is a pretty arcane, interesting thing, but I think it's important. So the city is considering changing the building code to allow only single stairwells to be built in apartment buildings up to 5 stories.
So that's like to fit one person.
Sorry?
Single stairwells?
Single stairwell. Basically, if any building over 2 stories right now has to have a front and back stairwell, basically.
Oh, so yes. Wait. So wait, there would be just one way in, one way out?
Exactly. And okay. So basically, advocates argue that this would help developers build more housing, give them more space, because you wouldn't have to have a central corridor connecting those exits. You would save money not having to build a second staircase. There's, you know, it possibly could bring in more density to buildings, which would then trigger the city's affordable requirements. So this has been talked about a lot. in the so-called, we already mentioned this, the YIMBY circles, right, the abundance circles, as a way to kind of do some deregulation and boost housing production. It has gotten some pushback, and yesterday there was a subject matter hearing, and the city's fire department and buildings department basically said, no thanks, this is not safe, we need redundancy, we need to have these two stairwells.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
Advocates countered and pointed to some studies that, you know, this is actually already common practice in New York and Seattle and some other cities, and they say it's been safe there. And through modern fire, anti-fire protocols, sprinklers, self-closing doors, that, you know, there is really not this need for the second stairwell. So, you know, there is a strong case for it, but I do think there is this gut reaction when you hear this of like, oh, I kind of want to have my second staircase to get out of here.
That sounds unsafe.
Sketchy wooden staircase in the back.
In the back.
Yes, I have one of those in my house.
Exactly. Yeah. Everyone does. Yeah. It's part of what makes Chicago, Chicago.
Yeah. So I think it's an ongoing conversation. It's interesting.
Right.
You know, part of the larger conversation over how do we make it easier to build housing in Chicago and in Illinois.
Now, Mawa, immigration arrests, they're not making as many headlines in Chicago as they did back in the fall, but they're still happening, right? And there was a startling incident witnessed by our Sun-Times colleague Violet Miller this week. Can you fill us in on that?
Yeah, so Violet was in Albany Park when she saw ICE agents crash into another woman's car while chasing and detaining someone. An ICE agent aimed a taser at bystanders and at Violet as well. There was another agent that pulled out a can of pepper spray and pointed at the crowd. And
sheesh.
Yeah. It was just a really chaotic and violent scene from how she describes it, you know. And she says an agent dropped a fully loaded bullet magazine onto the street, which was picked up later by a supervisor. And, you know, as a man was being wrestled and detained on the ground, agents threatened to arrest the woman whose car had been struck. So kind of like reminiscent almost of like what we saw in the fall, which is very sad.
A big reminder that it has not stopped, folks. Just because you're not hearing all about it every single day, it's still immigration enforcement is still very much happening in and around town.
Right.
Now, you reported, Quinn, on an update on the city's lawsuit against the bus companies that began driving migrants from Texas here to Chicago back in 2022
yes.
and 2023.
So everyone will remember this started in the summer of 2022 when buses unannounced showed up from Texas under the direction of Republican Governor Greg Abbott, bringing migrants to Chicago, dropping them off with little to no coordination with the city. I continued on through 2022, but then in the spring of 2023, it really ramped up. And that's when we started seeing people having to sleep in police stations. This, I think we can all say, was a humanitarian crisis that happened in Chicago at the direction of Abbott and some other border state governors. The city was overwhelmed, both from a financial standpoint and also just a logistics standpoint. So in the fall of 2023, the city changed some rules around bus drop-offs for these rogue buses that would just show up and drop people off in the middle of the night, no clothes, no shoes, whatever, and said they had to have pre-authorized permission from the Chicago Department of Transportation. You had to get that a couple of days in advance to do these drop-offs. Basically, no buses did that. Very few did that. So the city started filing lawsuits against some of these bus companies. Took a long time because there was a related federal suit that lasted until the beginning of 2025. The city has basically either settled or gained default judgments, which is basically what happens when companies don't show up to court, against about almost 100 of these 100 cases, about 27 bus companies in total. They're going to bring in hopefully about $440,000, almost all of that is going to be donated to the United Way. It's not going to come back, most of it, to the city coffers. It's going to go to, you know, this social services organization that has worked with migrants and other other people who.
Also not surprised that these bus companies were not showing up to court.
Yeah, I mean, most of them did not, right? So it is interesting. I mean, on the flip side, the city spent millions, tens of millions of dollars on the new arrivals mission, as they called it. More than 50,000 people were probably more. That was the number that they put out at the end of their tracking at the end of 2024, came to Chicago and had to be rapidly housed and fed and given clothing and, you know, services. So we spent tens of millions of dollars that we're not going to get back. I mean, we're not going to be reimbursed by the federal government or Texas. And so this is really kind of, I see this as a somewhat symbolic thing of the city said, you did wrong. Again, this is also against these bus companies, not against the main architects of the people who shipped these people here.
Now to some different vehicles that have made their way to Chicago AD. These ones were actually invited, though. Talking about NASCAR. Are they hinting at roaring into town again next summer?
NASCAR itself is not. The folks that they are talking to have. Okay. The gist that we're getting from folks in the know, including the head of the Grant Park Advisory Council, is that NASCAR is looking to come back next summer, potentially around the Sueños Music Festival. So part of the big beef with NASCAR was how long setup and takedown took.
Right.
And the limited access it gave to Grant Park for people that live near there. Like, they're like, this is our park. This is where we walk our dogs. This is where we enjoy green space in this concrete jungle.
Right.
Of Chicago.
So, New York?
No.
The other concrete jungle.
Yeah, we got one here too. So the idea of setting in at the same time as Sueños is like you reduce the load time, essentially. And there's some talk of like using their grandstands as well for kind of like the festival activities that also took place during NASCAR. There were musical performances and food vendors and all that kind of stuff. So part of the deal would like shorten that time even more and also not have it on July 4th weekend, which mm-hmm. seemed to tick off aldermen in particular.
Not good timing, that's yeah. for sure.
But nothing official yet.
Okay.
Like, as we talked to people, things weren't signed yet. So it might be a slightly different setup, but it sounds like the goal is not 4th of July, but still a big weekend and shorter setup time, piggybacking off of another festival.
Right. One more story involving vehicles, Quinn. Changes have come to the bike lane on Elston Avenue.
Yeah, this is a hyper-local story, but about a month ago, I reported on the pretty insane traffic situation on Goose Island,
yeah.
stemming from the Chicago Halsted closures, one of several bridges that is currently closed for repairs on the north side and downtown, which has gotten a lot of pushback from aldermen and neighbors who have said it's caused crazy traffic backups. Division Street in Ellison is one of the worst parts of this. So I was standing out there a month ago, and there's a partially protected bike lane going north on Ellison, meaning there are some curbs, but also there you can it's kind of open too in some cases. And cars were literally, I have video of this, just peeling into this bike lane and using it as a traffic lane to get around geez. Like dozens of cars and then take a right on Division Street. I have this photo of this one huge Escalade behind a cyclist definitely have hit them.
This is a nightmare.
It's a nightmare. And so clearly there was an issue here. So, quietly a couple weeks ago, the transportation department installed some bollards to basically, mm-hmm. Make sure this couldn't happen. Probably they're plastic, so you still could technically drive through them if you were really, trying to do something reckless. I would not put it past people,
especially Escalade drivers.
I do think this will dissuade most of the bad behavior. In the meantime, though, traffic is still terrible.
All right, two news items that I want to just make sure our listeners are aware of. The Eisenhower Expressway was shut down for almost 9 hours yesterday. That's because bomb squad technicians were called in to investigate a death in a vehicle, and it caused traffic to be backed up for many, many miles. And in the early morning hours last night, there was a tragic mass shooting on the South Side's Back of the Yards neighborhood. 7 people were injured, 2 fatally. Now, in other news, I wonder if any of you have seen the swimmer sculptures that have gone up?
Not yet.
Not
along
in person.
Michigan
just
Avenue.
Photos.
Only on social media.
They look pretty cool.
Right? Like similar to that, the Cows on Parade, right? This is what 10 sculptures of swimmers.
Cool.
And they're huge. Aren't they like 3 stories tall?
Life size?
They're not 3 stories, but
them.
they're slightly larger. They're maybe like 10 feet tall or something. Like they're, they're pretty big.
Oh, right.
Wow.
I wonder how long of a stretch they go down.
I think they go from basically like the Wrigley Building up to Oak Street, maybe.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, on the Mag Mile.
Very cool. Well, WBEZ is going to be diving into the topic of public art. Yes. Say more with Mary and Pat on Monday at 10. So make sure you tune in for that conversation, because I'm sure they're going to talk swimmer sculptures in that chat. Now, how about y'all? Are there some issues or stories that maybe we didn't cover today, or something that really resonated with you this week that you want to flag?
I saw Chalkbeat had a write-up of the different candidates who have filed petitions to run for Chicago School Board. There are 51 people.
Yeah,
that's
a lot of people.
Full slate
it's
of
a lot
people.
Of districts.
A lot of districts, too. Yeah, and I guess there's 21 board positions that they're hoping to fill or like people for.
And the at-large, right? The school board as well. That's, mm-hmm. that's the one I'm watching closely.
Yeah. So I wasn't on the education beat when this bill was going through Springfield to like create this system of electing school boards. But I just, was watching it kind of on the periphery, and I was like, oh, this is kind of like juicy. I don't know.
Yeah, it's heating up.
Yeah, no, really a lot is. Of people jumped into this race, including the pastor who married me last year.
What?
Whoa.
We got a text, my husband and I, like, hey, I'm running for school board. Wow. His name's Michael Neal, so look out for his name.
What district?
He's, I don't know the number, but he's in the Bronzeville area. Okay. So whatever district that covers. But yeah, he's all in. It's the social media videos have begun, and he's like really into it. He's been, you know, very much involved in the community for so long. He's got a community center. He's got a church. Wow. So he's like, this is kind of only the next natural step.
I wonder if that's part of his campaign strategy. It's like, ooh, he marries people, then like gets their votes.
Yeah. It was a very strange text. And I was like, okay, yeah. Just kind
of, thumbs up
it,
emoji.
Gave it a little heart and a thumbs up emoji. And what's on your radar for the week ahead, Quinn?
Well, one thing that got announced this week, but will start on Monday, is the YMCA of Metropolitan Chicago is giving out free memberships to teenagers all summer long.
Awesome.
I think it starts Monday and it goes sometime until August. And this is, you know, not explicitly, but certainly a response to the teen trends, the teen takeovers seeing. You know, such a foundational issue, as we keep hearing and as you've talked about on the show, are giving teens places to hang out and do programming. And this is one attempt to try to help with that, the third space. And so, you know, the Y says we could maybe see up to 5,000 new memberships this summer.
Love
so
that.
I think that's a small but important win for
the city. So you'll keep an eye. Real quick, Mama, what are you looking at? I mean, you get a break. Maybe you're taking a nap next week.
Perhaps I am. But there was another bill package that didn't pass, which is the AI regulations one. So I'll just look into why that didn't pass.
And AD?
I hate to always talk about taxes, but there is going to be...
All right, that's it for the week.
Thanks so much. It was great to see you.
My thanks to AD Quigg of the Chicago Tribune, Quinn Myers of Black Love Chicago, and WBEZ's Mawa Iqbal.
This episode of the In the Loop podcast was produced by me, Andrea Guffman, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/in the loop. Thanks for listening.